Good evening and welcome to Peace Talk, a production for KTOO Radio's Focus on Community.
Once some guy went so far to say try to imagine no heaven, no hell, and no God. No king, no country, not even possessions. We all thought he was asking a lot. So we kept on fighting for all of this stuff. But it never turned out to be reason enough to justify losing people we loved. Yeah, that's what we did before the end of war. The end of war.
Peace Talk is a monthly program produced by the Juneau Chapter of Veterans for Peace. It's VFP's contribution to our community's ongoing conversation about war and peace and the important issues and questions they raise in our society and around the world. I'm Rich Moniak. 2 weeks ago, Veterans for Peace and the Juneau People for Peace and Justice collected signatures for a petition to send to Alaska's congressional delegation, our state legislators, and the Juneau Assembly members. The petition states, quote, "We, the undersigned, will not allow fear-mongering to drown out our compassion for those seeking refuge from war or violent conflict or our humanitarian obligation to ease their circumstances. Therefore, we urge our elected representatives to work toward resettlement of refugees to Alaska in a manner that is inclusive, humane, and expeditious." End quote. In a matter of 10 days, 1,300 people signed it, most of them while attending the three-day public market. They were greeted at the entrance to Centennial Hall and the Jack with petitioners holding small posters that said nothing more than "Welcome, refugees," signed the petition. The majority who signed it didn't need an explanation or any coaxing. People seemed anxious for a way to have their voices heard over the loud clamor of hatred and bigotry that's attempting to dominate America's political discourse. This isn't a political issue, though. It's about human rights and human dignity. And it's about the values America is supposed to stand for. Our small action won't change what's happening right now in this country. And after the shooting in San Bernardino, it's only gotten worse. But we mustn't be silent. We must also recognize there is fear among Americans. Just because we think it's not justified doesn't make it so. We need to be open to those who are willing to discuss their fears with us. Not to try to change their mind, but to listen with a different kind of compassion. That's the meaning of tolerance, and it's a display of a different kind of strength. However, I'm not advocating that we tolerate the politicians and pundits stoking people's fears. In particular, our collective voice needs to ring louder than Donald Trump. Party leaders on both sides are condemning him. As the Atlantic Matt Ford said, quote, "The immediate danger isn't Trump's actual policy, but the bigotry and violence that it both legitimizes and encourages." End quote. The conversation amongst us right here in Juneau needs to stay strong with a peaceful tone. So in our small way tonight, we'll be bringing you three local voices and their stories. First, you'll hear from Lisa Fu. She is, of course, a reporter for K2 News, and she has a unique view into the life of a refugee family. I spoke with her about it the weekend before last.
You recently filed a report in K2 News about a few refugees who came to Juneau, and one was about a boy named Vo, and he left Vietnam as an 11-year-old, fled by boat to Indonesia, and eventually wound up in Juneau, where he was adopted by the Schroeder family. Now, that story relates to your story. Do you want to tell us about that?
Sure, yeah. So Vo Schroeder, which is his adoptive name, he has a Vietnamese last name. He was what the group of people that fled Southeast Asia during that time, they're called the boat people. And I'm not actually sure if that's a very politically correct term for them. But it was a term that I grew up with. My family as well, they were boat people. It was late 70s. My family is from Cambodia. They're ethnically Chinese. You know, historically, there was so much going on during that time, and I don't know the historical timeline that well. But obviously, it was in the mix of the Vietnam War. My family was in Cambodia, so they were living through the Pol Pot regime. And it was during the late 70s, what is known as the killing fields, where a lot of people were being forced into more of the country land and forced to do field labor. My family were, I guess you would call them middle class. And they lived in Cambodia pretty close to the border of Vietnam. My mom, my three cousins, and my two sisters at the time escaped Cambodia. And my mom talks about how during that time it was so dangerous in Cambodia that Vietnam was safer. So I think they were living there in Vietnam for a bit. They all escaped by boat to Thailand. And my father was caught, and so he was arrested. So he did not flee with my family. They were in a refugee camp in Thailand. I think my mom says it was about maybe 7 or 8 months. But my mom was pregnant with me, and then they got sponsored over by the Quaker Friends Meeting House in Chappaqua, New York, so the Quakers. So my family came over to New York June or July of 1980, the summer. And I was born that September. So how my family came to be in America was just like this narrative I grew up with in the background. But I never really knew the full story because I was just a kid. My mom talked about being in the refugee camp and waiting each day going back to see if my father would arrive. And she would talk about boats of people coming in and many of them not alive. You know, and those are the sorts of stories that I need to capture from her. And that's kind of been my goal in life, is to get my family story before it's too late.
Were there other family members besides your immediate family that left with them? And did they come to New York? Did they settle anywhere else?
So it was my mom and my two sisters as my immediate family, and then three cousins. No, and then besides that, my mom has kept in touch with other families that she knew at the refugee camp, but not family members, like people who ended up in Canada or other parts of the lower 48. And then I guess we have, on my father's side, some family members ended up in Paris. And my mom had, there's me and two other sisters, two older sisters, and my mom had another daughter. And she left that daughter with a family because it was too dangerous. So when I went to Paris many, many years later, I think either I was a teenager or early 20s, my mom's speaking with our relatives and talking about how my sister was with this family and just talking about how what ended up happening to her. I think she ended up getting really sick and passed away. It was just strange because I'd grown up knowing that I had another sister, knowing that she had died. But being older and my mom talking about her with another family member, and they're, you know, just talking in this different language that I don't understand, to think about what my mom went through. And she was in her, like, early to mid-20s, you know? She talks about coming to America as, you know, as a kid pretty much, like really young. And we grew up with the members of the Quaker Friends Meeting House being really close with us. So they had sponsored us over. They put us in a house that my mom rented for more than 20 years. Being Quakers, they never made us convert, right? But they always included us in all of the family events. You know, there were different families, and we all grew up with them. I was a kid, and they were all older families, older couples. And one of them, I guess, passed away at some point, and my mom went to his funeral, and she talked about him being like a father figure to her. And so there's just like all these things that have made me realize, sorry if I'm getting emotional, like how young my mom was. You know, she was probably like 10 years younger than what I am now, you know? I mean, in many ways, I talk about my mom being my hero. You know, to like do all that stuff and witness so much stuff. And then to come to America in her mid-20s with two kids pregnant, three of my cousins who she was responsible for, and starting this totally brand new life here. And yeah, I mean, they were refugees, and people were so welcoming to her and made sure, I mean, they put us in a house. There's one couple, Steve and Meredith Weddle, who I think were very instrumental in bringing my family over. And they signed me and my two sisters up for dance class. You know, like, they made sure that we were always okay. And we're still close with these families now, which is really great. But, I mean, my mom talks about learning English in a year. You know, she got work. She went to school later in life. But just all the stuff that she did.
So there's a lot of history she hasn't told you about her time in Cambodia.
Like, it was just so interesting growing up and knowing that my family had this history, and writing about it when I was a kid. But you have your own narrative of how things were, but I have no idea how things were. And in college, I did an internship for the Hartford Courant and kind of wrote about my identity, which had a lot to do with being Chinese, because I actually didn't realize I was Chinese until I was like in my 20s. And writing a lot about my family's history or their story. And it was published. It was like on the front page of their Sunday magazine. And my mom reading it and saying, you have a lot of things wrong in this story. And so, yeah, so I've known that I've needed to interview her. I need to just sit down with her for probably many weeks and just talk to her. But that's like a very big endeavor for both of us. And my family isn't we're not very emotional people. My three cousins, Lin, Kwong, and Min, when they came over, my mom said that they were younger than they were, though, so that they could go through school. But they were older, and they have their own stories, too. My two sisters were 2 and 4, so they were very young. But, yeah, there's so much history in all of those people that I need to...
So your mom was in her mid-20s, you say, when she came to the U.S. That would mean, you know, 1980. And during the early 70s, she was a teenager at the time. Her late teen years would have been the years that the U.S. was bombing across the border. Did she ever talk about that?
So just in 2012, I've been to Cambodia a couple of times as an adult in my 20s, and just this latest in 2012. And I was with my husband, and we went to Cambodia just as tourists. And my father ended up coming to America in like 1990, 1991. And at that point, I think my mom had sponsored him over. So he has his story too. I mean, I don't know what it was like for him in jail and all that stuff, but he finally came over when I was like in fourth grade. And at that point, we were this very very American family. We all spoke English. My mom and my cousins drove cars. They had jobs. And so when my father came over, it just did not work out. I mean, he's, you know, this middle-aged Chinese man coming into, you know, people who he kind of knows but doesn't really know. And it just did not work out. So he ended up going to San Francisco, and he had a donut shop business. He had two shops where he sold donuts, and got away with just speaking kind of business English, but he still never learned English. So he lived in America for about maybe a little more than 20 years and then moved back to Cambodia, so that when Scott and I went through, my father was there and living pretty much where my mom and him grew up. And so we walked around the town that my mom was raised, and he showed us places. Like, he showed us where she lived, where her uncles lived, the movie theater that they had gone to, the market that they went to, some, you know, river that they used to play on. And when I told my mom that later, she had no idea that anything was even still standing. You know, she thought that everything would have been in ruins. When I showed her photos, she was just completely shocked that everything was even still there. They must have left that town at some point, and I think had gone to Vietnam or close to the border for several years before they finally escaped. But whatever happened, she must have thought, she thought that it was not there anymore. But it was. And she was really shocked. And my mom says that she'll never go back.
What about hardships in her first years here? I mean, for you growing up, everything was normal because it's all you knew. But does she tell you about any particular hardships that in adjusting to a new culture?
I've never asked her those questions. I mean, those seem like perfectly great questions to ask my mom, but I've never asked her. I mean, I know she was just so determined that I don't know what hardships she would even bring up. I mean, when I was learning Chinese in college, you know, because she was determined for us to learn English, right? So I never learned any other language. And my mom speaks at least five languages. And so when I was learning Chinese in college, she had zero sympathy for me because she was like, I learned English in a year. You know, it's just if you want to do it, you do it. So I imagine she obviously had hardships. I mean, she was a single woman raising a family, but I've never asked her about them.
So is it safe to say that by the time you were old enough to start thinking about these things and you look back at your past, there didn't seem to be any, that your mom had overcome anything before you were aware that what a hardship would mean?
I mean, we were surrounded by so much support in terms of these families that were part of the Quaker Friends meeting house. You know, if there was any hardship, there we would have gotten help for it. You know, like my mom, what she was really great at was getting scholarships for all of us to go to like dance classes, summer camps. Like there was nothing we didn't have when it came to like an all-American lifestyle. We weren't like affluent by any means, you know, but my mom like did everything she could that we had an affluent lifestyle, which is pretty amazing. Like I went to sleepaway camp in Cape Cod, and then we all went to private colleges, you know. Like she was just really great with finding ways to make it happen.
Have you ever wondered that if your dad had come at the same time, if he would have adjusted the same way as a family, and his hardships are exclusively that your mother got so far ahead of him?
You know, I've never even thought about that. It's, you know, I think about, I always thought, you know, it was sad growing up without a father, of course, you know. But it never occurred to me what it would have been if they had come together, because my mom is such a strong woman.
What about cultural values that your mother would have brought from Cambodia that she instilled in you? Do you have any sense of that, that you look back at as a heritage you want to maintain?
Well, so I think that was a lot of my, like, identity issues growing up. I went to school with a lot of, you know, white kids. But my mom sent my sisters to Chinese school. She never sent me to Chinese school, but she sent them. And they hated it, you know. But she really did try to retain Chinese culture in us. So my mom was Buddhist. You know, she grew up Buddhist, but I didn't know that until as an adult I lived in Hong Kong and my mom came to visit me. And we visited some, like, Buddhist temples, and she knew exactly what to do as far as praying. I didn't know that. I mean, I think when she got to the refugee camp, I believe she converted, she got baptized to become a Christian because I think she thought that'd be easier to get sponsored. So growing up, we went to church. She didn't go, but she made us go. But there were certain things, like there's like a moon festival or something. Her and my cousin Lynn would take us outside and they had like apples and fruit and they were praying to the moon. And as a kid, I thought that was so silly. And I think me and my sister just like laughed. But I mean, we ate Chinese food growing up. We went to Chinatown every time we went into the city. And a lot of that stuff I resisted. I resisted it so hard because it was like so different than what I was being surrounded with. So I really didn't embrace that side of myself until I was in my 20s. But I mean, just my whole life is based on the fact that my family escaped and then were sponsored over by the Quakers. I mean, that's like everything that my sisters or I accomplish is thanks to that, you know?
So one last question, I guess, you know, aside from escaping violence and going, traveling across to Thailand by boat, there are other similarities that you see between your mother's experience and what Syrian refugees may be experiencing today.
I mean, when I was interviewing Vo and then Parisa, and I interviewed another Iranian woman as well, who she didn't end up in my story. I mean, there's the commonality between every refugee, which is that nobody wants to leave their home. And I think we've heard this over and over, but I mean, that's just like a very basic thread between everyone, every refugee who it's like nobody wants to see violence. Nobody wants to have conflict in their home, or nobody wants to, like in the example of the Iranian Baha'is, nobody wants to be persecuted, right? And I think everyone embraces their new home differently, depending on your circumstance. My mom came with two kids, pregnant, and three cousins. Like, she had to adapt very quickly. So, but it's the whole, like, why you have to leave. I mean, that's the common thread with everyone. And I think, and what people talk about as well is being embraced by their sponsor or sponsor's friends or just the community, right? Like Parisa Alohian, when I interviewed her, just thanked everyone who accepted her in Juneau. She's like, even when my English was bad, she said she never once felt discriminated against here. I mean, Vo, I mean, he was taken in by the Schroeders. You know, how much more can you feel welcome? So I think it's just in my family too. I mean, when I think about growing up, we had so much support. And I think you could just like any refugee who comes into a new country and their children, however much they know the story, it's like you can never thank the people enough who helped you.
You're listening to KTOO in Juneau. I'm Rich Moniak, and this is Peace Talk, a Veterans for Peace production for K2's Focus on Community program. You just heard K2 radio reporter Lisa Fu talk about her life growing up in a refugee family. It's an amazing story about a mother from a different culture who was welcomed by decent Americans and combined their goodwill with her own courage to help create a wonderful life for her children. Our second story tonight is from Libby Bacalar. Libby is an attorney who was born and raised in New York City. She's been in Alaska for the past 10 years and in Juneau for 9 of those. She's also the writer of a popular blog called One Hot Mess. Libby is married to Jeff Kirsch, another writer, and between the two of them, Juneau gets a great dose of fascinating intellectual humor about life on our modern-day last frontier. Libby and Jeff have two children who are the main priority of their work and family life. I spoke with Libby last Monday about a very different New York experience and how that and her family's heritage shaped her views about the Syrian refugees.
You produce a lot of writing for your blog, and you've referred to it as a humoristic look at life in Alaska.
Pretty much, yeah.
And it's been on Wheel Askins up in the Alaska Dispatch News.
Yep. I've had a couple of pieces from the blog sort of repurposed for Wheel Askins, maybe I want to say three, that they've used. The op-ed I did on the refugee crisis was a different sort of animal. That I submitted that independently to the opinion section.
And you don't generally submit things to the opinion section?
No, I've never submitted anything to the opinion section before this. The Dispatch had approached me about the Wheel Askins pieces because I assume they read my blog and like it. And so it had just been kind of humorous pieces that they had used up until this piece that I, of my own volition, decided to submit to the op-ed section.
Okay. And let me read a paragraph from that I want to begin our discussion from. It says, and this is a quote, "I was in New York City on 9/11, two blocks from the World Trade Center. I watched people die and thought I too would die that day. So perhaps more than many residents of Alaska, I know what it means to be in the middle of a domestic terrorist attack. But refugees fleeing ISIS are not meaningful threats to us, certainly no more than any American who decides to shoot up a movie theater." I think your experience on 9/11 is highly unique to what most Alaskans remember. So why don't you describe that in a little bit more detail?
Well, I was 23 at the time, about to be 24, and I was working for a city agency, actually a city agency that investigated police misconduct called the Civilian Complaint Review Board. And it was located on Rector Street, which is one of the small streets at the, for people who are unfamiliar with the geography of Manhattan, it's an island, and the tip of Manhattan is a very, is one of the earliest settled parts of the city, and it's a very condensed area. The whole financial services industry is there, along with a lot of city agencies and various office buildings, and the streets are very small, and they go to a point, you know, into the river. The Staten Island Ferry's right down there. So I was... it was just an ordinary day. I went to work, and I usually get there 10 minutes to 8. And I was on the phone, and a coworker came over to me and said, you know, a plane hit the World Trade Center. And I had assumed it was a tourist plane, and I asked her if she thought it was, and she said, no, I'm hearing, you know, it's a 747. And so we went downstairs to watch what was happening, and we could see, you know, there was a very large hole in the I don't remember which was the first tower that was hit, but that tower, a giant hole, flames coming out, paper raining down, people, figures, stick figures from that distance and height falling out of the windows. And while we were standing there between the first and the second planes hitting, I was standing there on the street when the second plane hit, and you could see it coming over the highway. And here it hit the second building, and that's kind of when there was, you know, kind of pandemonium that erupted then. And I ran up and got all my stuff from my office and started to walk home to Brooklyn, where I just moved from northern Manhattan, or I had been living on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and then I'd recently moved to Brooklyn with my boyfriend, now husband, Jeff. And two coworkers and I started to walk towards the Brooklyn Bridge, and there was just kind of chaos and pandemonium at that point because no one knew what was happening. No one knew how long it was going to last. People were talking about the D.C. bombing and that kind of thing. And it was apparent at that point that, you know, the first plane, people thought it was an accident or arguably an accident. And then the second one, it was obviously a terrorist attack. And everyone sort of acknowledged that. And there were people crying. There were, you know, people having like heart attack, seizure type. I mean, there was basically a lot of chaos going on. And there's really only one way to walk because to the north is the buildings. From where my office was, to the north were the buildings, to the south was the water. And to the west is the highway and more water, and to the east is Brooklyn where we lived. So there's only really one way to go towards Brooklyn. And the Brooklyn Bridge is, you know, a mile or so, I think, from where the World Trade Center was. And we made our way over there, and we were walking across the bridge at the time the first building collapsed. And when it started to collapse, the bridge shook, and it was like an earthquake. And I definitely had a feeling that, I definitely had a kind of an out-of-body experience at that moment, and kind of this calm feeling came over me, and I felt like, you know, it was a definite possibility that this bridge was going to collapse, because I'm not a civil engineer. I have no idea, you know. All I knew is that I'm in the middle of the bridge. There's a building falling down, like pancaking down, and the whole bridge is shaking. I remember looking around at the cables on the bridge and thinking to myself, trying to come up with a plan and a strategy for what I was going to do if basically something happened to the bridge that I'm in the middle of with thousands of people. And there were people freaking out kind of for that reason on the bridge. And I got sort of this, like I said, a calm feeling like everything was going to be okay. And I was going to, not that I didn't care what was going to happen to me, but I just felt like totally calm, like able to cope with the emergency, but also sort of like, well, if it's my time, then I guess it's my time kind of a thing. And I was sort of impressed with that. Your body senses that there's an emergency and it has to cope with what's going on around you. And needless to say, that was a short window of time that I felt that. It was, you know, probably 10 seconds that I thought I was going to die in that moment. And then, you know, the earthquake subsided and, you know, we all proceeded over the bridge and I got home and, you know, opened the front door and my boyfriend, who I lived with, was crying hysterically, and there were 16 voicemails on my answering machine. And because the way it looked from far away, you would think everybody in any 5-mile radius would die from what was happening there, because it looked so catastrophic, you know. And my parents, who live in the Bronx, still live there in the same apartment I grew up in. Their next door neighbor was a firefighter, and he died on 9/11. So my parents were really worried, and I had one coworker of mine died of a heart attack, and nobody else I was close to or knew died, which was really fortunate considering how many people I know in New York. I'm a fourth generation New Yorker. So that was basically my 9/11 experience. You know, I pretty much witnessed it firsthand from very close up, from beginning to end. And I was very traumatized for a long time after that, and it actually gave me a really interesting insight into war, because I could only imagine what people who are in combat, what they experience after that. I mean, every time I would hear a loud noise, I would jump out of my skin. It gave me a new appreciation for basically for PTSD and shell shock and that kind of thing. Because even that one very small exposure to war, it gave me a real appreciation for what soldiers must experience in battle. Because I remember a squirrel ran across our fire escape that night, and I literally jumped, you know, 10 feet under my skin. I did not really realize I was not conscious of being anxious of that. It was just about kind of a bodily response to that hour of time.
Obviously, the mood in New York City, a lot of people experienced what you did. A lot of people were traumatized. A lot of people struggled coming through that like you did. How did that magnify in your mind, you know, your own trauma? That it was shared by so many, or did that help?
I think it probably helped. And, you know, at the time I was applying to law school and deciding whether I wanted to leave the city to do that, and I ultimately decided not to. Some people, I think, decide to leave the city after 9/11, and I decided to stay there, not exactly because of 9/11, but, you know, people talk about that time immediately after 9/11 as one of the better times in New York City in terms of kind of the best elements of human nature coming out. People were very kind to each other during that immediate aftermath, and there was sort of a shared experience of every stranger on the street. You know, normally in New York, people ignore each other and look into space and don't, you know, want to exist in their bubble, because if you didn't, you would just be overwhelmed by the crush of humanity that's there. But right after that time, there was a lot of, it felt like a small town in some ways, in a way that I hadn't experienced before there. So I think it was a good time spiritually for the city in some ways, because it gave us all a sense of unity.
Obviously, you referred to knowing PTSD in a new way, but that was before the wars. And PTSD was probably not something on many people's minds back then. But neither was, you know, people leaving the Middle East. The refugee question that you wrote about may not have been an issue back then. But one of the things that did begin immediately after that was what the fear of Muslims.
Right.
What did you feel from your own perspective, as well as what did you glean out of the city's attitude towards Muslims in general?
Well, you know, I think the city is, New York City is one of the most tolerant places in the world. There isn't really the room for bigotry that there is elsewhere, because everybody lives very near each other. Everyone rides the subway together. Everyone sees each other every day. Everybody works with a diverse group of people. I mean, there's only so much isolation that you can have from people of other races, sexual orientations, ethnicities in a 16-square-mile island, you know, Manhattan, and the rest of the city, you know, 20-something miles full of 11 million people. So, you know, I think most of the bigotry is probably confined to places where there's no exposure to people of other races, religions, and ethnicities. I didn't get the sense. You know, I know it exists and it's out there in pockets of the city, but the kind of Islamophobia that we're starting to see, you know, now is not something that I particularly noticed in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And it's not something that I noticed, you know, that I felt in any of my visits back to New York City since I've moved back to up to Alaska. So, to me, I get the sense it's more prevalent in places where everyone's white and Christian and just doesn't have the exposure to different cultures. You know, I'm also Jewish, even though I'm basically an atheist and I'm not religious, but I'm conscious of the fact that, you know, my entire family is Jewish, my husband, my kids, my parents, and everybody that I can count going back, you know, many generations. And obviously there's a lot of conflict between Jews and Muslims, even though they're basically the same religion, more or less, in many significant ways, coming from the same area of the world, and being subjected to a lot of the same prejudices, actually, despite the fact that they're, you know, in high conflict with one another. So, you know, some of the rhetoric we're hearing around Islam right now is very similar to the rhetoric that we heard around Judaism during World War II. So I'm personally cognizant of that. And I know a lot of my friends and family who are Jewish feel the same way, because, you know, this is nothing new under the sun as far as they're concerned. And, you know, people who are demagogues, you know, rise to power under conditions like this. And it's scary. And so, you know, it's important to, I think, to speak out against that stuff when you see it happening. Otherwise, you can count yourself complicit in it. And that's something that you're taught as a Jewish person growing up, that you owe that a debt to history to speak out against that kind of those genocidal impulses when you see them.
Well, now, the refugee situation coming out of Syria has been going on for a while. And even before that, there were serious refugee issues as people left Iraq during that war, the breakdowns in other Middle Eastern states following the Arab Spring in Libya. It didn't really hit the American consciousness as it should have, maybe, until this past September, when that boy was photographed, that young boy photographed, who had drowned on a Turkish beach. And did you notice anything then, as the discussion about bringing refugees coming to the States began, that alarmed you?
Well, I mean, I saw that picture along with everyone else. And, you know, my son is very similar in age, a little older than that. And I think any parent certainly looks at that picture and your heart just breaks because you put yourself in that person's, the parent's position, you know. And that's all that these folks are, as families, just like everybody else. There's actually a great little YouTube sort of tutorial about the refugee crisis produced, I think, by the UN. It's narrated by someone who's British. I'm not sure. That kind of breaks it all down in 6 minutes and explains the origins of it, why it's happening, and what the Western response has been and should be to it. You know, I think now more than ever, we are a global society. It's not like World War II anymore in the sense that we don't have the separation of nation states that we used to have. And you can't cloister yourself as you used to be able to, because there's the internet, there's photography, there's, you know, widespread social media. And it takes 2 seconds to get an image like that traveling around the entire world. And, you know, the world is very globalized, both, you know, for better or worse. And so, you know, we're all in this together kind of a thing. And in my opinion, you know, when you ignore something like this, you do it at the peril of, at your own moral peril, for sure, but also just economically, it's not sustainable for the world to continue to have the distribution of resources that it has right now, to have, you know, some countries and some people in some countries living at such an extravagant standard of living and others literally, you know, having to watch their child drown because they're trying to escape, you know, their civilians caught in a complete civil war, and to not have the you know, the 1%, for lack of a better word, do something to help, I think it's just unconscionable. And it's also very un-American and unpatriotic. Even though, you know, we don't have the best history of living up to those ideals, those are the ideals that our country is founded on. It's founded on these ideas, and certainly, you know, what's on the Statue of Liberty echoes that. And I think, like I said in the piece, you know, it's an abdication of those ideals to basically just, you know, wash our hands of this crisis, say it's somebody else's problem. You know, I had some pushback. A friend said, well, would you, you know, take a refugee family into your house? And I said, absolutely, I would do that. I mean, people all over Europe, you know, housed many relatives of mine during the Holocaust and many relatives of my husband's. There was, you know, a counter movement against Nazi Germany that took a lot of personal risk to sequester Jews from Nazis. And so, you know, fortunately, in this country, we have an organized refugee resettlement process. You don't have to hide people in a barn or an attic like you had to, you know, in World War II. But, you know, so I don't think there's the opportunity to do that kind of, return that kind of favor now. But what I'm saying is, you know, if there were, I wouldn't hesitate to do that at all, because I just think that's a human obligation.
That was Libby Bakalar of Juno talking about why she felt compelled to speak out on behalf of refugees from the Middle East and West Asian wars. Unlike her, very few people have really had to analyze their fears after experiencing a real terrorist attack on American soil. She was back in New York recently, and while flying home, she wrote a piece for her blog titled On Turbulence and Terrorism. She wrote, quote, "The deepest vulnerability of the human condition is, of course, death, our own and those of the people we love. In this way, turbulence and terrorism share some common features." End quote. It's an interesting read, and a companion piece to consider reading is a New York Times opinion by Jessica Stearns titled How Terror Hardens Us. She's a professor of global studies at Boston University and a co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror. She mentions something called terror management theory, which she suggests, quote, "that much of human behavior is motivated by an unconscious terror of death. What saves us from this terror is culture. Cultures provide ways to view the world that solve the existential crisis engendered by the awareness of death." End quote. Stearns also explains that managing our own terror is part of the responsibility of standing strong against terrorism. Before we move on, let me say for those who tuned in late that you're listening to Peace Talk on KTOO. I'm Rich Moniak. Now our last story tonight, related to refugees, comes from John Gagin. John is a retired state attorney who has been living in Juneau for about 40 years. He has had a radio show on KRNN for many years and is very involved in supporting people in the community through Meals on Wheels and the Glory Hole. I spoke with John last Monday afternoon.
This past fall, you took a trip to Eastern Europe that had took an interesting turn. Why don't you tell me about it?
Well, it was going to be a routine two-week tour to Poland and then down the Danube. We went to Prague and then down the Danube. And that was obviously at the time when the first great masses of the refugees were heading up into Central Europe. And we were on a bus and we were going from Vienna into Budapest. And I don't remember the exact day, but it was the Friday that Hungary finally decided to stop being totally oppressive. They had been, if you remember seeing in the news, there had been thousands, maybe tens of thousands of refugees crowding around the central train station in Hungary. And Hungary finally decided that they would bus the people to the Austrian border. But before that, a lot of the refugees had decided that they were just going to walk to the border, which is about, I'd say at least 100 miles, because they didn't really see any option. That was when Hungary, like I said, they weren't busing people to the border. They were busing people. I think people got on the buses and thought they were going to the border, and they wound up busing them to camps where the conditions were supposedly just awful. Well, that was real interesting, but the most interesting part was 2 days later. I had stupidly left my passport in the hotel in Vienna, and we were in Budapest, and we had to go back to Vienna to get it. So we took the train. We went down to the train station, and there were still a lot of refugees there. Like I said, it was nothing like it had been a couple days before, but there were still lots and lots of people there. We started out, we talked to a family. It was a father and I think two kids. I remember at least three of them, and they spoke very good English. And we were talking to them. They were Syrian. And one of them started saying, well, with the help of Jesus. So we realized at that point that they were religious, they were fleeing religious persecution in Syria. And I think this was a group that had said, although so many people told us this, I can't say, that they'd been robbed on the way. I mean, the trip is not just long and tiring, but it's dangerous. Then we got on the train. I think that they had probably canceled all of the regular trains for that day. I think they were using them just for refugees, because I think that we may have been the only non-refugees on that train. We got on the train. It was packed to the gills. People were standing in the aisles and sitting in the aisles, things you obviously wouldn't allow on a normal train.
And you weren't inclined to get off for being afraid of anything.
No. The only time I had any fear at all, and my wife tells me that I shouldn't have, there was a guy who was getting very loud and belligerent with his friends or with the group he was with. And I was a little afraid that might turn into something ugly. But no, I felt no fear whatsoever.
And how long was the ride back and how many people did you interact with?
The ride back was about, I'd say it was about 5 hours probably. And we had to change onto an Austrian train in Hungary, but we were no more than a couple miles from the border, I don't think. And when we first got on the train, we were sitting with a group of four young men. One of them was Syrian, and he spoke very good English. The other three were from Baghdad. And one of them, who was sitting right across from us, you could tell he had really hollowed-out cheeks. It turns out his teeth had been kicked in, and he told us that his parents had been killed. And these are the Baghdadis. And we offered them some money. We had offered some money to the group at the train station, and they wouldn't take it. And we offered some money to this group, and they did take it. And I'm very glad they take it, because I know they had said that they were robbed. I think they'd been robbed in the last couple of days, probably in Serbia. This was one thing that was really appalling to me. We get on the train, and it goes a ways, and then it stops. And nobody knew why it stopped. And that, you know, the group we were with, I think for very good reason, was quite nervous about this. In fact, one of them was opening the window as though he was going to jump out. But the train started again. And then shortly after that, there was a group of Hungarian police officers come into the cabin. They asked the people, "Do you have your papers?" They knew perfectly well that nobody on that train had papers. And they kept asking, you know, it was pure harassment, pure and simple. They just wanted to scare them for who knows what reason. Nothing happened as a follow-up to that. And then there were a large number of people, I think they were Austrians, who had food and water. You know, they were just handing these out at the train station. Because, you know, a lot of these people hadn't had anything to eat for a while. And they gave out bananas. They offered us a banana. They offered my wife a banana. And she said no, because she didn't want to take their food. But they just kept insisting. You know, they wanted to share so much. And I split a banana with somebody. And so, you know, it was really nice to see that kind of support, at least coming from the Austrians. And then, like I said, when we got to the border town, we had to switch to another train. And when we got on the other train, we were sitting across from a very lovely young Afghani woman, and she had a 2.5-year-old and a 4-month-old. They spoke very, very little English. But there was a man standing next to him. They were seated, and there was a man standing next to them. And somehow I got the question across, is this the children's father? And they knew enough to say, no, brother-in-law. So I was assuming, and maybe I'm, you know, maybe it's not true, that the father of the children, the woman's husband, had probably gotten killed in Afghanistan. And they were fleeing at this point.
And what happened to the people you met as you were departing? You all got off the train together somewhere.
Well, this was interesting, and it makes sense. This was at the Vienna train station. They kept everybody on the train because they wanted to have an orderly disembarkment. Because one of the group of four people we'd ridden with the train. And actually, we were with them. They got us seats because my wife had to go to the restroom. And when we came back, I think they had taken the seats, but they were just holding them for us. So they gave them to us. They were hoping to spend the night in Vienna, you know, to get a cheap hotel and just rest a bit. But when we got to Vienna, right on the track next to us, there was a train going into Germany, going to Munich. So what they did was they wanted to not let everybody off. You know, they didn't want a mass rush of people to the next train. So they just they did it in an orderly way, and then everybody was going to be in the promised land by 9 or 10 in the evening.
So I understand you and your wife are involved in a foundation that supports refugees.
Yeah, we've... We got a connection with a woman who works for World Relief Seattle, and they're doing a lot of work with refugees. I think more at this end, you know, they are helping to resettle the shamefully low number of refugees that the United States has decided to take. In fact, we just heard from them recently. We're not sure whether it's one family of 8 people or 8 Syrians. have arrived in Seattle, and they're involved in resettling them. They have infants, so, you know, they need cribs, they need diapers, and all that stuff.
But your involvement with this began before the Syrian crisis, and so that suggests that you've been open-minded and welcoming to refugees and have a wide range of experience that most people don't.
Well, so I won't say the wide range of experience. But,
well, then compared to most people, though.
Well, I have now.
Yeah. So getting on the train in that situation for you may not have been as difficult as it would be for somebody who hadn't even considered the plight of refugees in their lifetime.
My guess is that most people wouldn't have gotten on the train at all. You know, most people probably would have said, this is too dangerous, and it wasn't in the least.
The one thing people fear in this country is that some terrorists are going to slip through, and you can't guarantee that there were no terrorists on that train. You know, how would you address people who have that fear?
I would say it's a remote possibility that terrorists are using the refugee stream to come west, but I think they can get west. You know, if they want to get west to do terror, they're going to get west some other way. They don't need to do it under the cover of the refugee.
And what about Cindy's reaction throughout this time?
She had, like I said, she wasn't even nervous when this little squabble started, and the squabble, obviously, that had nothing to do with terrorism. It appeared to be, you know, people who've been traveling through impossible circumstances for 2 or 3 weeks, and you reach a breaking point. You know, I assume they were speaking Arabic, but I had no idea what the fight was about. And it really, you know, it really makes it different. You read about the refugees, but to actually be in the midst of them, and to actually be able to talk to a few of them. I would love to know, you know, if somehow we could see what happened to the people that we talked to in the train station and on the train. I would love to know what happened to all of them.
Well, there's nothing like human contact face-to-face that changes impressions as well as creates the curiosity about the remainder of people's lives that you don't see again.
That's true.
You've been listening to Peace Talk on KTOO in Juneau. I want to thank Lisa Fu, Libby Bacala, and John Gagin for sharing their personal stories related to the current refugee crisis. If you missed these, you can download the program later next week by going to ktoo.org, to the program's drop-down menu, and to Focus on Community. Before I sign off, I want to say a special word in remembrance of Father Thomas Weiss, who passed away earlier this month. Father Tom was only 46 years old. He was a member of Veterans for Peace and very active with our work during the years he lived in Juneau. He will be missed by all who knew him. Our next show will be a month from now on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, always a fitting day to discuss the work we must do to create a more peaceful world for us all. Peace Talk is a Veterans for Peace radio production brought to you on behalf of Juneau's Peace and Justice community. I'm Rich Moniak, wishing you a good night and a happy holiday season.